Welcome to another edition of The Debate. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has decided to add the Yemeni resistance movement, Ansarullah, to his annual blacklist of parties violating children's rights. Now, this is happening while the ongoing war on Yemen and the continuous Saudi blockade is taking its toll on civilians, mostly women and children. In this edition, we will be scrutinizing the different aspects of this decision with a look at the bigger picture, but first, a report.
Yemen's Ansarullah movement blamed the United Nations for the Saudi atrocities committed against Yemeni children. The movement said the UN has always been providing the political cover-up for the Saudi war crimes. This came after the United Nations added the Ansarullah movement to its blacklist of groups for violating children's rights.
We were not surprised by this decision because the UN had removed the name of Saudi Arabia from its blacklist of the groups violating children's rights. The United Nations have not taken any real steps to protect the rights of Yemeni children who die every day due to continued blockade on food, medicine, and fuel. I believe that this is a resounding scandal for the Secretary General of the UN, who began his second term with this decision.
The member of the Supreme Political Council, Mohammed Al-Houthi, dismissed as baseless the UN accusation, saying it did not refer to an investigation on the ground as the movement has demanded. Meanwhile, the Minister of Information said the UN has turned a blind eye to the ongoing Saudi blockade on Yemenis, which causes the death of tens of Yemeni children on a daily basis.
This classification wasn't based on realistic data. We used to have the United Nations as a political cover for the war on Yemen and the killing of more Yemeni women and children, whether because of the continuous Saudi blockade or because of the airstrikes of Saudi fighter jets. This decision revealed to the world the true face of the United Nations, that it serves the agenda of the countries funding the UN.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war against Yemen in March 2015. The war has killed thousands of civilians, including women and children, and turned the war-torn country into the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations.
Observers say the United Nations blacklisting of Ansarullah is politically motivated and has no relation to the humanitarian situation in Yemen. They believe that the UN must take real actions against the Saudi blockade if it has real intentions to end the suffering of millions of Yemenis. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
Now to continue this discussion, we're joined by Mr. Hamza Shaiban, a Yemeni activist and political commentator out of Sana'a, and also Ms. Judith Bello, senior member of the United National Anti-War Movement. Thank you very much to both of you. Let's begin with Mr. Shaiban. Now, how do you think this decision will impact the UN and particularly its international image?
Thank you for having me. Unfortunately, the UN continues to be a platform for countries like the US and help them to provide the political cover. Unfortunately, such a move is not based on reality, and basically it's based on falsified reports or politically motivated. We all remember the war crimes and the atrocities that the Saudi US coalition has committed in Yemen. There are thousands of clips that were documented showing dead children who are half torn sometimes. But nevertheless, this did not motivate the UN to put Saudi Arabia or US in the blacklist. We all remember the incident that happened in Saada and Dahyan, where a school bus was bombed and 52 children were killed. In Yemen now, every 75 seconds a child dies because they don't have access to food or clean water. And this is according to the director of the food program in Yemen, World Food Program.
And what you just mentioned
you
is
know,
a direct
this
result.
This is not different from.
What you just mentioned is a direct result of the Saudi blockade on Yemen, isn't it?
Absolutely. Today in Yemen, more than 80% of the population is in need of humanitarian assistance. This is because of the blockade that is imposed by US and Saudi Arabia on Sana'a's airport and Hodeidah port. And back to this move, I believe this is no different from what happened in 2016, when Secretary General Ban Ki-moon enlisted Saudi Arabia in the blacklist of groups that violated children's rights in Yemen. And Saudi Arabia, after that, threatened them that they would cut the funds that they give them, which was approximately, I think, 100 million. A week or so after that, they had to take them off the list because, according to Ban Ki-moon, he said that they were put under pressure by Saudi Arabia that they would cut the funds. Again, this is something that definitely is not surprising from a UN, from an international institution like the UN, who should be credible. Nevertheless, they tend to be not neutral in this war, and they're not playing a very positive role in the war in Yemen. I believe that if Yemen had money and they could pay the UN, they wouldn't have been enlisted Ansarullah movement in this list. We all saw what UN provided to the children in Syria, to the children in Lebanon, to the children in Palestine, most importantly. Definitely, this is just a continuation of a negative role that UN is playing when it comes to protecting and providing political cover for countries like US and Israel.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shaiban. You actually pointed out some very interesting issues, and also that flashback to the time when Saudi Arabia paid the UN. The UN actually took Saudi Arabia off the list because it was worried about the payments that it was receiving from Saudi Arabia. Let's bring in Judith Bello. Ms. Bello, if you could please tell us what you think. Is the UN chief actually serious in bringing peace to Yemen?
I don't think the UN is serious about its response to Yemen at all. They are behaving as a proxy for the Western powers right at the moment. The only base they have down there, the United Nations, which through which all the food and resources have to come into Yemen, is on a U.S. base in Djibouti. So they basically have deferred to the Western assault on Yemen, and they're riding it out rather than rejecting it. And the Saudis, the U.S. has given complete cover to the Saudis, even though they now have some stuff going on in Congress in opposition to it. The U.S. government is not terribly interested in what the people want. And they obviously have doubled down on their support of the Saudis in this matter. I think it's really a crime that it's going on the way it is. And the United Nations gives legitimacy to this nothing government of Mr. Hadi in Saudi Arabia, while at the same time they do not give legitimacy to Ansarullah, who are defending their country. And I think this right there says it all, that the United Nations in this particular matter, and they have had moments when they did a little bit better, although not frequently, or not every time. In this particular matter, the United Nations is totally co-opted by their, not just Saudi money, but their major benefactor, which is the United States.
Now, Ms. Bello, Antonio Guterres is actually blacklisting Ansarullah as a party violating children's rights. Interestingly, we have witnessed Saudi Arabia and its allies purposefully targeting children. We've seen school buses being targeted by Saudi.
Let me just say one more thing about this. You know, during the Iran-Iraq war, Saddam Hussein was mercilessly using chemical weapons on Iran and the Iranian people, and they were also using them on their own people in the Kurdish areas in the north of Iraq. And while they were doing this, Iran repeatedly, this is against the United Nations rules, so Iran repeatedly went to the United Nations and said, first they were the aggressors, and now they're attacking us with these illegal weapons. And the best that the United Nations could do, again, because this was a U.S.-instigated war, the best the United Nations could do was to condemn, quote unquote, both parties. And they never did single out the actual perpetrator of these atrocities. And this is a problem with the UN. As the United States does not live in the real world. It lives in the world of what it wants. do or say anything. When I say it, I mean the blob, the Washington blob or whatever, not necessarily the people of America. But they will do whatever they want to oppress and humiliate those who they want to overcome. And they've done this to Bashar Assad. They did it in Libya. They've done with the horrific murder of Gaddafi, the president at the time, and they're doing it in Yemen by refusing legitimacy to the one group that is broadly defending the country. They did it in Gaza with Hamas. They found a way to blame them, like if Hamas, you know, retaliates against an Israeli attack, then all the deaths that come from it are Hamas's fault. This goes on and on, and I don't know the answer to it. I know that it's an evil policy. Very hard to work with the American government because, as I say, they really don't care what the people think. And they, as Mr. Pompeo said a few years ago, they lie, cheat, and steal. That's their training. And then they do whatever it takes. And I am very glad that Acerola is there defending their people. I'm not sure what this will cost them. I think it costs them what they already don't have, which is the control of incoming resources. Because what happens, of course, from the very beginning, the way the blockade works is that Saudi allies and United Arab Emirates allies get food, get the things that they need, get weapons, and Acerola and the people of the majority of the people of Yemen go without, because that's part of the strategy of the war. And by doing this, it's just, in my opinion, it's sort of rubbing their nose in the dirt. It's a deliberate attempt to humiliate them and to, in some ways, maybe propagandize people in the West who are foolish enough to believe whatever the UN says. But the bottom line is that stopping them is a big problem. And the Ansarola has fought long and hard, and they've had some gains, and they're making some progress against the Saudis. So we just have to hope that in their persistence and in their connection with other countries fighting for their lives against the same group, in connection with the Palestinians, in connection with the Lebanese, which under Hezbollah, in connection with the Syrians, that if the people of the region stand together and persist, that eventually the world will retreat. That there won't be a choice to persist.
Hopefully, that's
because this is so wrong.
I'm sorry to cut you off. Let's bring in Mr. Chabon, since you mentioned the U.S. Mr. Chabon, the U.S. is providing logistics and arms to Saudi Arabia to continue this war on Yemen. Why doesn't that result in any serious measures from the U.N.?
Sorry, why doesn't that
result in any serious measures from the U.N.? The U.S. is actually providing the arms, the logistics, everything for Saudi Arabia and its allies. We don't see the U.N. condemning the U.S. for that.
Yeah, as I mentioned, unfortunately, the UN is acting like a platform and providing political political cover for US and other countries to do whatever they want. They basically gave them a free check to do whatever they want in Yemen, in Palestine, and in Syria as well. I truly believe that UN cannot be as an international institution, UN is not a neutral party when it comes to defending victims and condemning the aggressors. As long as they're getting funds from Saudi Arabia, as long as US is supporting them in a way or another, they will continue doing whatever they want to do, and UN will just, try to beautify their image, U.S. image, and keep providing them with excuses to implement their agenda in the region, which is destabilizing the countries and making sure that they're not independent and they don't take a stance against their agenda in the region.
Ms. Bello, because of these different aspects that we have been mentioning so far during our show, Yemen's Ansarullah has slammed the decision of Antonio Guterres, calling it disgraceful. Do you believe that this view is shared by many across the world?
I actually do believe it's shared by most of the developing nations in the global south. I do not think any of them are fooled by the behavior of the United States and Saudi Arabia in this case. And that is a reason for hope in a matter like this, because much of the world sees through these actions by the United Nations and by the United States, and they are resentful of countries like Saudi Arabia. The United States blames other countries for having dictatorships while ignoring the abuses in Saudi Arabia and the murders of people that happen there at the royal discretion and so on. So I think that this is our strongest positive that we have going for us in creating a better world, is that the countries of the global south are not fooled. They all understand what's happening here, and they are gradually building their strength.
And let's not forget, Ms. Bello, let's not forget that we live in a day and age that with all of these mobile phones and different tools that people have, it's very difficult for mainstream media to shape public opinion as it used to decades ago. And it's, of course, more difficult to hide the truth. So how far do you think the UN can go?
To be honest, I don't know how far they can go. I do think that they lack legitimacy even here in the United States, because so many people feel that the United Nations has been co-opted by U.S. politics. But sadly, or maybe for the better, that many people continue to try to work with the United Nations because it's the only global forum that we have. And so they pass resolutions to do things that are often ignored, like the ones against nuclear proliferation, or the ones against other kinds of weapons, or in support of human rights. And even though these are abused at the moment by the United States and nations, it remains that it's a global platform. And I think that's really the only legitimacy it has here, even in the United States, because it's been under attack. And that's one of the problems. You have the United States destroys its tools.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shaban. Could we hope for any change in the UN chief's angle towards this issue? Could we hope for any change in the UN chief's angle towards this issue?
Now, this depends on whether the UN is actually trying to show the truth about what's happening in Yemen, or whether they're trying to justify whatever the U.S. and Saudi Arabia are trying to do. As long as the UN is being backed by Saudi petrodollars and U.S., I don't really think that anything will change.
And
the war in Yemen has been going on for almost 7 years.
Thank you very much. We're running out of time, so I would like to have Ms. Bello's response on this question as well. Ms. Bello, do you believe that we could expect any change?
I think there's some potential for change just in the shifting of international strength in terms of the growing strength, for instance, of China in global politics and other things that are happening that actually weaken the United States. So I think there's some possibility, but I don't see any immediate relief on the horizon, because this entire war in Yemen has from the beginning been under at least the outside external control of the United States. And the United Nations has been submissive to the U.S. agenda all along. So I guess I think long term that there's potential for a relief, but not short term.
So we have to keep and continue making programs like this to raise more awareness, to get people to know what exactly is happening. Thank you very much to both of our guests, Hamza Shaban, a Yemeni activist and political commentator out of Sana'a, and Ms. Judith Bello, senior member of the United National Anti-War Movement from the U.S. Thank you very much to both of you. And thanks to all of you for following this edition of The Debate.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoint.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, let there be light, and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint. A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to another edition of the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, and my dear guest, Brother Hussein. Salam alaikum. Welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum salam.
And other guest, Sayyid Abdullah. Salam alaikum. And welcome to the studio again.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is mine. Well, we were talking about the movie God Sent, a 2004 drama thriller movie directed by Nick Ham and starring Rick Neer, Rebecca Ramin-Stamos, Robert De Niro, and Cameron Bright. As we talked about this movie in the last episode, a serious issue came up, and I asked Brother Sayyid Abdullah, and now I'm going to follow up this question with you, Brother Hussein. We all know that, you know, cloning, by definition, of course, depending on what kind of or type of cloning we are talking about, whether it is, therapeutic or reproductive or even gene cloning, normally you're talking about, like, in this series of movies that we are trying to focus on, we are talking about reproductive cloning. And by definition, reproductive cloning is like you create an offspring, an organism, a living organism, or a group of cells within an organism through asexual means or reproduction, basically. All right? And what we are talking about is like basically they take away the nucleus of the egg cell or oocyte, and then, like, this is the biological process that they do within a reproductive cloning, and then they take
they replace that
an asexual cell and inject it. Of course, there are different techniques. They inject it into the egg cell, and then they put it in the female ovum. And then the process continues until it is born.
So it's a natural pregnancy.
Kind of natural pregnancy from then on, right? We are talking about, or we are looking at, like, physical cells, organisms, like, being born, all right? The first part is manipulated by man, the second part by nature, all right? But this movie tries to push this agenda of, like, the soul cloning, not like bodily cloning. Don't you agree? Like, when the son, in fact, the clone, of course, the cloned son reaches the eighth birthday, all right, then it happens to have, like,
traumatic memory.
Exactly, traumatic experiences of the deceased boy.
Yeah.
So that happens to be like something extra to the physical realm. Don't you agree?
Yeah, so I feel like what they were trying to push is the concept of fate and how whatever you do, the person has a destined conclusion. His destiny, his fate.
Mm-hmm.
So in the case of the boy, he was bound to die at that age and in that way. So whatever you do, even if you clone him, you put his DNA into the body of another person, he will still experience that traumatic event, regardless of, where he is or how he is, in which form he is.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Yeah.
Okay, let's take a break and we'll be back continuing the topic of cloning within the movie Godsend.
Cells are in essence clones, identical copies of one original cell. Now, key to artificially stimulating replication is in shocking a specialized cell back to its pre-specialized state, its stem cell precursor, the cell as it was before it became a liver cell or a brain cell or a relatively simpler cheek cell. Once in this state, the cell's nucleus is immediately transferred to a mother's enucleated egg. Transfer completed, the egg cell will then ideally accept the donor nucleus as its own, at which point we let nature take its course.
Back to the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. We are talking about Godsend, this 2004 Canadian-American horror drama, directed by Nick Hamm. Sayed Abdullah, if that is true, the soul kind of cloning, which is brought up, the idea is brought up in this movie, what happens to the reward and punishment system that we have, proposed or espoused by religion? Because... religion considers every individual within the free will,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And they are not forced to do anything. But
right.
It seems that this clone kid is somehow predestined or doomed to have the experiences at the 8th birthday.
All right, so we can look at it from a science perspective and from a religious perspective.
Yes.
From science perspective, a creating or cloning a soul is an impossibility. You can create the body. If Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala decides to give the body a soul, that would be a complete soul because that in Allah's hand.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So they cannot give a human being, they cannot clone the soul.
Yes.
That's period, right? Because it's the soul itself. Even the Quran says, they ask you about the soul. They say it's from God affair. What you know is nothing. So we cannot clone
exactly.
The soul. Hypothetically. Hypothetically,
okay.
We're talking here. If they were able to clone a soul,
yes,
right, and that soul itself now is a clone of the other soul, right?
Yes.
So, if the guy continues his life with his free will, then obviously he has a free will, and Allah Subhanahu wa Taala will judge him based on his free will, right?
Yes, true.
If we say no, the guy is controlled by the demon or by the soul that was previous to his soul and that controls him, then Islamically we have a qa'ada, we have a formula that says إِذَا أَخَذَ اللَّهُ مَا وَهَبْ سَقَطَ مَا وَجَبْ. If Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala takes that which he gives you, then the hisab of it falls off as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because it would be unfair from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala,
yes,
to judge you based on something that's out of your will, out of your control.
Exactly.
So if that soul had the free will to continue after 8 years and live its normal life, then obviously Allah will judge it based on its actions. If not, and we're talking about hypothetically here, right? If not, if the soul has no control, possessed by another soul, then obviously Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is too just and too fair, too merciful to punish it for something that it had no control over. But that's all. But this is all hypothetical.
Yeah.
If the soul is being, you know, they're able to create or reproduce or clone the soul, but that itself is an absolute impossibility. No science could come in this. They could create the body, yes, but the soul, they cannot clone it.
I see. Do you believe that, Brother Hussein, that they can, one day in future, even as hypothetically as Sayyid Abdullah was talking about,
yeah,
like science would be so advanced, so like progressed to clone the soul or to be able to approach the non-physical part of human being?
Honestly, I'm not sure, but like they say, the environment you live in also affects you, and by you it means your soul, your mind, like how you act, how you live. So there might be a physical aspect to it. My point is that maybe, yeah, mm-hmm, there is a chance that this can happen, that cloning of the soul, of the mind, can exist as well. Not only do you have the body, but you have the same person that you were trying to clone, like in the movie.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, let's take a break and we'll be back and continue our discussion on this movie, Godsend, in this program, Viewpoint.
Richard, thank God. I want him in a hospital.
All my staff and I can handle
this. Well, your staff don't even know about this.
And they don't need to. It's the same as always. We're close friends. You know our arrangement.
Okay, maybe we need to reconsider our arrangement. It's 5 hours. He's still unconscious.
Respirations and color are good, and he's responding to low-level stimuli. He's basically just sleeping.
Except for some reason, he's not waking
up. Listen, what you describe sounds a lot like night terrors.
Night terrors?
It's a sleep disorder. A child screams in his sleep. He may sit up, walk, even talk, but all attempts to wake him are futile.
Back to the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. We are talking about the movie Godsend and the important concept of cloning, which is in fact brought up by this movie with our dear guests, Brother Hussein and Sayyid Abdullah. Sayyid Abdullah, do you think that one day, even in distant future, not near, that man will be able to approach the non-corporeal part of reality, of human being?
Well, see, the problem is there is no way in this life, or even let's say, there's no way in hell they can create a soul. Do you know why? Because the soul itself, it's been the topic of philosophers like thousands of years ago.
Yes.
They still don't understand what the soul is. Like, even if you see a movie called 5 Grams,
mm-hmm,
they said, okay, the soul weighs 5 grams because the body wants
yes
before it dies.
21 grams
of fire.
Yeah, 21 grams.
So it loses
with champagne.
Ahsant. Yes. So it says it loses 21 grams. That's the weight of the soul. What is the soul? What makes a soul a soul? We have absolutely no idea because it's beyond the metaphysics, right? We don't know what it is. Does it have a form? Does it take a shape? What is it? We don't understand. So how we cannot, you know, like scientists, they say, well, 90% or 95% of the world is made from dark matter. And they say we call it dark matter,
yes,
is because we have absolutely no idea what it is.
Yes.
So how
they
could you create or
theorize about it?
Yeah. So how could you create or recreate something you don't know? So would they reach a point where they would understand what the soul is? That's an absolute no.
Yeah.
Right? And the Quran confirms that fact. Yet, however, they might be able to extract information from a person's brain, because I think they are experimenting now.
Yes.
With the monkeys that I saw recently.
Yes.
They inject information in that brain that, for example, that other person had.
Mm-hmm.
Over, you know, like you've seen a lot of movies with a chip. And that the chip is reality, by the way. Like a lot of
True.
Like they doing it a lot for like blind people and some other people,
mm-hmm.
where they plant a chip and the chip could work, right?
Yes.
So they could come to a stage where they could extract information from you or me, and plant it in someone else's brain, which is the 6 day it tried to do.
This is what psychometry is all about.
Yeah. So you can do that maybe, like exchanging information and moving information from one person to another. That could be a possibility in the future. But to create the exact soul, like me, I live now, I died, and then I come back to life, that's an impossibility.
Yes.
Or like make a copy of me, which thinks like me, talks like me, like the sixth day, where he felt like, oh, this is my family, like, because it's my family.
Isn't this a kind of reminiscent of reincarnation, which is like...
No, even reincarnation, they don't believe in the same thing. Reincarnation,
yes.
They say if you die, you come back in something else.
Yes,
like
true.
If you die, you could come back, you know, in a flower or in a, you know, a cow or, I don't know,
exactly.
an animal or a plant. Even the Buddhists themselves,
mm-hmm.
or those who believe in the reincarnation.
Got
so
you.
Even they believe that you will only come back to life. If you're a good person, you will take a human form, but not the same human that you were before. And your soul will completely forget what it's been through. So you don't come back to life to continue what you lived. You come back fresh, with a fresh start, with a fresh
mm-hmm.
brain, fresh mind, and you know absolutely nothing of what happened.
I see.
But the only thing that if you're a good person before you die, you come back as a human being.
Yes.
If you're a bad person, then you will take a shape of an animal or a plant based on...
To be trained to be a better person and then to continue
it's sort of punishment.
Until
yeah,
you reach nirvana.
So even reincarnation itself, that's how it works. So it's quite different than what they're trying to portray in the movie, that you could actually clone a human being with the body and the soul. So
mm-hmm.
soul and mind.
I see.
You can give them information of the person that passed, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But to get the actual thing, well, like I said, we don't know what the ruh is or the soul is. So you cannot create something that you don't know.
I see. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you, dear audience, for listening to the program Viewpoint, your program on Arabi English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad. Saying wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
About you. IRIB English Radio.
Round the world with reporters. As anti-Westminster sentiment continues to rise, another part of Britain is entering the fight to break away from the UK. Cornwall, located on the southwest of the island, is witnessing the start of a new pro-independence advocacy group which aims to revive a lesser-known campaign for Cornish independence.
All Under One Banner's Cur Now is the latest branch in a wider organisation which already has roots in Scotland and Wales. In both countries, All Under One Banner has achieved significant success in opening up the debate on independence. Locals in Cornwall are hoping to achieve the same.
Many Cornish people, who are recognised as a Celtic minority, have various grievances with the English-centric London rule, including a lack of funding and a systematic destruction of an ancient culture.
That's a good way of explaining it. We're a long colonised place, possibly longer than the Welsh, who also probably feel that they've been colonised as well. But we've recovered that history, and that's one of our greatest successes. And the greatest challenge now is decolonising the history and explaining it to Anglo-Saxon ears.
In past campaigns, activists have been branded as nationalists who hate the English, a claim rejected by locals.
I've got no problem with the English or with any other nationality at all. What I have a problem with is the way that possibly we are represented through them, and the way sometimes we are talked down to and treated by them. But no, there's no problem at all. We have so many friends from all over the world down here.
For now, Cornish independence is a minority view, but lifelong campaigners believe things are changing.
I think we're already getting there in terms of greater autonomy, understanding the need for it. The next question is how to get it, and obviously there are political ways of getting it, but there's also a need for people to go out and campaign for it.
The idea of Scotland or Wales breaking away has sent shivers down number 10. This latest development in Cornwall will surely only worsen Downing Street's fears. Robert Carter, London.
The US Justice Department committed a new flagrant violation of the freedom of the press and blocked several regional outlets' websites, including the Yemeni channel Al Masira and Iran's Press TV, claiming they are linked to what it calls Iranian disinformation efforts. Yemenis condemned this move, saying it proves that the US calls for freedom of speech are lies.
The seizure of some of the websites affiliated with the resistance front comes amid the media war. The Saudi-led coalition has been trying since the beginning of its war on Yemen to cover up its crimes committed against Yemenis and to mislead world public opinion.
Yemen's Ministry of Information said the U.S. government seizure of a few websites confirmed the strength of the media of the resistance and proved that these websites revealed the true face of the U.S., including its participation in the brutal Saudi war on Yemen.
We condemn the seizure of some websites affiliated with the resistance front. This move shows that these websites have been strong enough to influence the American public opinion by releasing the realities on the ground. It reveals the falsehood of American claims about democracy and freedom of speech. Certainly, there are solutions to this blocking, and the websites will be running again.
Ali Ashrai, the manager of Al Masira website, said this move revealed the weakness of the U.S., even though it owns thousands of media outlets.
This step reveals the great weakness that the United States is suffering from, even though it owns thousands of websites, satellite channels, newspapers, and radio stations. However, it was unable to withstand a few channels with limited capabilities which convey the truth as it is and express the opinion of the free people in this world.
Experts believe that this step is part of a media war of the U.S. government against the media outlets of the resistance. They said these attacks will persist and the resistance access should be ready for further violations.
Yemenis say the freedom of speech is a fundamental right for all free people of the world, and the United States has no right to deny individuals or communities this right. They believe that such attacks will promote the free media outlets to continue exposing the U.S. policies. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A number of Palestinian prisoners are going on with an open-ended hunger strike to protest their illegal imprisonment without charge or trial under Israel's so-called administrative detention. At least three prisoners insist to continue their strike despite their seriously deteriorating condition until Israel releases them. Among them is 28-year-old Ghadanfar Abu Atwan, who has started his hunger strike almost 50 days ago. After starting his strike, Israel's prison authorities placed him in isolation. Later, he was transferred to Kaplan Medical Center south of Tel Aviv because of his serious illness, and he's being held there under detention.
Of course, when all doors are shut down in the face of the prisoners to get rid of the administrative detention, they have few means to protest and they have to engage in the hunger strike battle, especially that many prisoners' terms are renewed for several times and this without charge or trial. When Ghadanfar started his protest, he was beaten and tortured by the Israeli jailers and he was held in solitary confinement.
Palestinians held a protest in solidarity with the prisoners outside the Red Cross Committee building in Ramallah. The oldest of those taking part is 59-year-old, a senior leader of the Hamas movement, Jamal al-Tawil. joined in protest over the detention of his daughter, journalist Bushat Tawil. He's demanding Israeli authorities to release him and his daughter. Israeli court had extended Bushra's previous administrative detention order last March. There is also Sheikh Khadr Adnan, prominent leader of the jihad movement, whom is staging his fifth hunger strike. This is the 12th time he has been detained.
Today we are here not only to stand by the prisoners and support them. This is the least we can do against the administrative detention policy. Israel arrests people from all walks of life and different political spectrum. We are in real need to launch a national and worldwide campaign to force Israel to stop this policy that exposes the Israeli authorities and their illegal practices.
The Palestinian Prisoners Society said the Israeli authorities have lately increased the use of administrative detention against Palestinians. The committee said Israeli authorities issued 200 administrative detention orders since the beginning of May. The majority of the hunger-striking prisoners are those who are held arbitrarily under Israel's policy of administrative detention. That's why they put their lives on the line to demand not only their freedom, but an end to the administrative detention policy. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
The U.S. Special Envoy for North Korea visited South Korea for talks with both his South Korean and Japanese counterparts. Sung Kim then repeated Washington's desire for dialogue with Pyongyang.
Most importantly, we reaffirmed our two countries' shared commitment to pursuing the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula through diplomacy and dialogue. We took note of the recent statement out of Pyongyang regarding their preparation for dialogue. And we hope to receive a positive response to our proposal for a meeting soon.
U.S. President Joe Biden's new point man on North Korea, however, conditioned any negotiations on U.S.-led sanctions against North Korea remaining in place, which many see as a barrier to kickstarting broader denuclearization talks. Some activists suggest the tension provides the U.S. an excuse to deploy troops to the region and support American weapons producers.
The importance of the Korean Peninsula has increased as the U.S. military pressure and response to China has been strengthened. The traditional diplomatic and security establishment of the U.S. wants to maintain a certain level of conflict on the Korean Peninsula.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un last week told officials at a party meeting to be prepared for both dialogue and confrontation. Pyongyang later responded to Washington's offer of talks with ridicule, suggesting a wrong interpretation would lead to disappointment. The U.S. may be paying more attention to North Korea with the appointment of a special envoy in his five-day visit here to South Korea. The question is whether that will translate into greater flexibility from Washington in terms of offering Pyongyang some sanctions relief as North Korea deals with the COVID-19 pandemic and recent natural disasters. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In less than 2 months, Iran's president-elect Ebrahim Raisi will take over power, and speculations over the fate of the 2015 nuclear deal is now the talk of the town, while there are still major sticking points in the Vienna talks over the revival of the accord. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said the discussions are likely to reach a conclusion before the end of President Hassan Rouhani's term in mid-August.
There is a good possibility that we will reach an agreement before the end of our tenure.
In his weekly briefing, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said the U.S. is slowing down the process.
Iran and the U.S. still have differences over some of the issues. What's ahead is for the U.S. to make a political decision and lift the sanctions.
Reports coming out of Vienna suggest that the excessive demands of the U.S. and European parties to the deal are to blame for the sluggish talks. The U.S. wants the destruction of Iran's new generation centrifuges in exchange for only a temporary suspension of some of the anti-Iran sanctions, a demand beyond Iran's commitments under the accord. In his first presser as president-elect, Raisi made it clear that the U.S. must lift all sanctions before Tehran returns to its full compliance to the atomic accord. He said he will not allow the talks to become erosive.
The Americans violated the JCPOA and the Europeans did not comply with their commitments. The U.S. was obliged to remove all sanctions under the JCPOA, but it has failed to do so. The Americans should return and fulfill their commitments. I tell the Europeans not to be impacted by the pressure and the foreign policy of the Americans and to fulfill their obligations under the JCPOA.
Officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, the nuclear deal has been in limbo for 3 years, since the former U.S. administration discarded the accord in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran. In a tit-for-tat, Tehran adopted a stepwise suspension of its own nuclear commitments. The last remedial step involved ramping up the purity level of enriched uranium to 60%, way above the 3.67% cap set by the deal.
The Iranian Foreign Ministry hopes the Vienna talks will conclude before Rouhani's term is over. Observers say this scenario is the best for the U.S., and any foot-dragging means the talks will have to continue with the new Iranian administration, which maintains a tougher tone toward the U.S. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The right to assemble, to demonstrate, to be heard by people in power, a cornerstone of democracy. Potentially under threat in proposed UK government legislation that gives the police sweeping new powers.
Police now, for the first time, are going to have the ability to restrict static protests or even to ban static protests. Now, making too much noise is going to be regarded as something that could be problematic. There's also a provision in the bill for a new crime of creating a public nuisance, which has incredibly a prison sentence of up to 10 years attached to it.
And it was those provisions in the bill that got people out on the streets over the past year, not just in London, but up and down the country.
Parliamentary committee's warning echoes campaigners' concerns that the policing bill is deeply imbalanced. Apart from issuing unwarranted curbs such as noise limits on protests, they say, it does too little to protect women. That it meets out longer jail terms, let's say for vandalism, than it does for sexual assault.
The government response has been one of denial and defiance. Our proposed measures, it says, are in line with human rights legislation and in no way impinge on the right to protest.
There is no such thing as a protest that doesn't in some way impinge or disrupt other people in society. That's the point. That's the nature of protest. There's a kind of hostility to the very kind of philosophical notion and nature of protests right at the heart of this bill, and that's why we shouldn't believe it.
The contentious legislation came after protests by the Extinction Rebellion movement that first began in 2018 and last year's toppling of the statue of a slave trader in the southwestern city of Bristol during the BLM protests. The UK government has a majority in Parliament. It remains to be seen if the ongoing protests, the warning from the Committee on Human Rights, and concerns among some of its own libertarian MPs will prevent the draft legislation from becoming law. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Iran's AB Home and several lawyers have filed a complaint against Mölnlycke Healthcare, a Swedish medical device company, over its refusal to sell medical products to Tehran under U.S. pressures. Mölnlycke Healthcare refused to sell Iranian AB patients medical care items they needed, including Mepilex dressings. Several children in Iran who suffered from epidermolysis bullosa lost their lives due to the lack of urgently needed medical equipment, and some others were hurt by severe physical injuries, including amputation. Many human rights groups have criticized the U.S. for cutting off banking ties with Iran through threatening the international banks with punitive fines by the U.S. Department of Treasury, which has resulted in cutting Iranian patients' access to necessary medical items.
Since May 2018, that the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA, up to May 2019, a number of children suffering from EB died only because they did not have Mepilex dressings. I want to tell those who claim to be defenders of human rights what has been the crime of this 37-day-old baby who died of the disease only because we did not have Mepilex dressings as a result of the U.S. sanctions.
The move has deprived EB patients, also known as butterfly patients, of essential medical items, killed many of them, especially children, and inflicted serious physical injuries, such as amputation, to some of the patients. The complaint seeks to protect the victims of the open violation of human rights committed by the Swedish company and prevent similar criminal measures.
The Iranian Center for International Criminal Law, an NGO based in The Hague, has submitted a complaint to the Swedish National Contact Point stating that the Swedish company had breached the OECD guidelines by failing to undertake appropriate human rights due diligence, adversely affecting the human rights of EB patients in Iran and failing to remedy its impact. The lawsuit calls on Swedish National Contact Point to hold the company accountable and take action to compensate for the losses Iranian EB patients have suffered and to resume trading with Iran.
Nearly 30 Iranian EB patients, mostly children, have died since Mölnlycke stopped selling its dressings to Iran, saying that for EB survivors, the pain has increased by 70%.
Iranian officials have repeatedly blasted the U.S. for imposing sanctions against the country, stressing that such inhumane sanctions have intensified the sufferings of kids with no access to special medicines for incurable diseases. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Iran's president-elect Ebrahim Raisi has highlighted the principles of his government's foreign policy in his first news conference since his election last week. Raisi took a jab at the US and Europe for the failure to live up to their commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA.
The Americans violated the JCPOA and the Europeans did not comply with their commitments. The US was obliged to remove all sanctions under the JCPOA, but it has failed to do so. The Americans should return and fulfill their commitments. I tell the Europeans not to be impacted by the pressure and the foreign policy of the Americans and to fulfill their obligations under the JCPOA.
This comes as Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA are engaged in talks in the Austrian capital to revive the accord, which has been hanging in the balance since former US President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew from it in 2018 and reimposed sanctions as part of his administration's maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic. Raisi said his government will support negotiations that ensure Iran's national interests, but also made it clear that his foreign policy will not be limited to the nuclear pact.
Maximum pressure hasn't worked on our people, and so they must reconsider and return. Our people have shown that they resist pressures, and they must know that foreign policy of our administration is not a start with the JCPOA and will not be limited to it either.
And this is how he responded to calls by some Western countries for including Iran's missile program in the Vienna talks to revive the JCPOA.
Iran's regional and missile programs are not negotiable. They have not fulfilled their commitments regarding issues that have already been negotiated and agreed upon. How can they enter into new discussions?
Raisi said his administration will focus on an expansive and balanced interaction with the world and would also be open to restoring ties with Saudi Arabia.
Ties with neighboring countries will be my administration's priority. With regard to ties with Saudi Arabia, there is no obstacle from the Iranian side to the reopening of embassies in the two countries.
Raisi also touched on the Saudi-led war on Yemen, calling for an immediate end to the conflict. Tehran has stressed that it seeks to establish ties with all countries based on mutual respect. Now it seems to be seen how Western and regional countries will deal with the new administration when Raisi takes office in August after he won over 60% of the vote in last week's election.
The week that saw British PM Boris Johnson's Conservative Party lose a previously safe parliamentary seat to the Liberal Democrats in a by-election northwest of London had another surprise in store. Former Parliament Speaker John Bercow changing allegiances and joining the opposition Labour Party and sharing harsh words about the Conservative Party and its leader.
if you believe, as I do, that this government is bad news, unfit to govern, and that the Prime Minister, though a successful campaigner, is a lousy governor.
The former Parliament Speaker went on to